From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet guitarist, singer, and songwriter Wayne Kramer. In the late 60s, his band the MC5 released the album Kick Out the Jams, and their music became the soundtrack for many political protests and demonstrations. The band is now considered one of the forerunners of punk rock. The MC5 broke up in 1972. Kramer spent time in prison on drug charges and later teamed up with the group Was Not Was. Then he went solo. His new CD is called Adult World. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the cultural right versus the postmodernists. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the late 60s, when a lot of rock bands saw themselves as being in the vanguard of a cultural or political revolution, the Detroit-based band, the MC5, was one of the most radical of them all. In the early days, they were managed by John Sinclair, the head of the revolutionary White Panther Party. The band was a critical success, and a popular one, too, with a top 30 album. The MC5 broke up in 1972. Now they are seen as a forerunner of punk rock and an early expression of heavy metal. A new documentary about the band will have its premiere at the Chicago Underground Film Festival on August 22nd and will be shown at the Toronto Film Festival in early September. My guest, guitarist, singer, and songwriter Wayne Kramer, was a founding member of the MC5. He's still performing and recently started his own label called Muscle Tone Records. It released his new CD, Adult World. Let's start with a track from Adult World. This is Talking Out of School.
Do I need a shower? Or do I need a shave? Do I need an inside tip? Is there any money that I can? Another's floor. See the heights of my extravagance, the rooms of the upper house, and the illustrates my true currency with their man of mouth. And I'll assassinate your character, 'cause I live by my own rules. And I'll write it all with the voice of faith. The talk, 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 talking out of school.
That's Wayne Kramer from his new CD, Adult World. Wayne Kramer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Wayne Kramer, how would you compare the music you're making now to the music you made in the MC5 era?
I think it's better. If I had to qualify it, music is one of those interesting activities that is not actually tied to being young. That you can continue to develop your ideas and your passion can go deeper and your technique and your craft become better and your ideas can be more stretched out as you get older. I mean, look in the world of the blues and in jazz. So I think that you don't necessarily have to pull over and park when you're 25.
Well, when you started playing with the MC5, rock was, a youth music then, and for you it was a revolutionary statement as well. So is it more about the music itself to you now?
No, you can't. I don't think you can take the literary or political or, you know, social content out of it. It's all one thing. It's all one message. It's all one communication.
Now, noise and distortion were a part of the MC5's music. Are you still interested in that kind of sound?
Love noise. Love noise, yeah.
What do you love about it?
I'm trying to think of music beyond the traditional forms of music. If I take the best Chuck Berry type guitar solo I can play and push it to the next level, I'm closing in on what the free jazz guys were doing in the late 60s and in the 70s, you know, where we're starting to move out of the beat, out of the key, into I'd like to think, a more pure sonic dimension. And there's a lot that happens in the world of our hearing and in what sounds represent that aren't traditional music, you know. I mean, in today's music, in sampling, you hear car horns and dogs barking. And to me, these are all just tools and techniques that I can use to tell stories more vividly.
Let's go back to the beginning, more or less, of your story. You grew up in Detroit. Did your father work in the audio industry?
In a satellite sense. You know, he was an electrician and later was in the building trades. And then I had a stepfather later on who also worked in he actually worked in an oil refinery there in Detroit.
Did you figure that when you grew up, your job would somehow be connected to the auto industry?
Well, that was my fear. You know, that's the birthright if you're born in the industrial Midwest, you know, that you're gonna end up a shop rat.
How was the MC5 first created? And let's place it. It was, what, 1968, 67?
Well, that's when we kind of broke out of a regional popularity onto the national consciousness. But we really started about 64, 65 in a neighborhood kind of way. You know, I looked around for guys in the neighborhood that wanted to be in a band and collected a bunch of ne'er-do-wells just like me. And we decided to call ourselves. We had a bunch of other, you know, subgroups. And see, it was a very competitive scene in those days. I mean, this is, you know, the boom time after World War II. Everybody has good jobs, and you can buy an electric guitar on credit from Sears, and they were everywhere. I mean, everybody, you know, everybody had an electric guitar. Everybody was in a band. I mean, it was really a popular activity. But, you know, we kind of coagulated as the MC5 at a point. Me, Rob Tyner, Fred Smith, Michael Davis, and Dennis Thompson. And really, you know, we really worked hard on what we were trying to do. We really worked hard on trying to be the best band we could possibly be, you know, be better than everybody else. Because for us, we looked at it as a way out of the factory, as an alternative to the lifestyle that we were guaranteed to have to fulfill. It just wasn't all that appealing, you know.
Well, the MC5 became, you know, a self-styled revolutionary group. What politicized you? What got you thinking more about revolution than Chuck Berry?
Well, Chuck Berry was revolutionary. But, you know, it was the day we were very much a part of the time we lived in. And this was a time in the 60s. And I know it's hard for people to have a feel for it today. But the country was fractured down the middle. And the war in Vietnam had created such a division in the generations between the older World War II generation and our generation that we really thought the whole thing could just blow up at any time. We just were frustrated with the slow pace of change. We were anxious about the future. And we felt like we had to take action. And the action we took was in endorsing our idols, which were the Black Panther Party and Malcolm X, and our, you know, our spiritual leaders, which we viewed as John Coltrane and, you know, and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Archie Shepp. And we tried to bring all these ideas together in a message that our band could represent self-efficacy, that we could present the idea that, you know, you didn't have to go along with the program, that there was a better way that we could do things.
The band hooked up with John Sinclair, who was the head of the White Panther Party. What was the philosophy of the party?
Well, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton put out the call for there to be a group in the white community and the hippie community to take up parallel work with the Black Panther Party. And we were ready. I mean, we just said, yeah, that's us, you know, and it was romantic and it was dangerous. But I don't want you to think that, you know, that we were sitting in a warehouse on the west side of Detroit, desperately cleaning our shotguns, waiting for the revolution. I mean, we sat around a table and smoked tons of marijuana and laughed our asses off at what was going on. And this all just seemed to make perfect sense to us, you know.
Let me read part of the 10-point program of the White Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
We want justice. We want a free world economy. We want a clean planet. We want a free educational system. We want to free all structures from corporate rule. We want free access to all information, media, and technology. We want the freedom of all people who are being held against their will in the conscripted armies of the oppressor throughout the world. We want the freedom of all political prisoners of war. We want a free planet. We want free land, free food, free shelter, free clothing, free music, free culture, free media, free technology, free education, free healthcare, free bodies, free people, free time and space, everything free. Bring back memories.
Love it. Boy, that sounds great.
did you charge for concerts, or were they always free?
Oh, we charged as much as we could. Unfortunately, many times they were free.
Speaking of free, I mean, I remember there were a lot of rallies in the 1960s. Free John Sinclair, who mm-hmm. was affiliated with the MC5 and was mm-hmm. arrested, sentenced to 10 years for carrying 2 cigarettes. So what was the relationship of...
To marijuana cigarettes.
I'm sorry, 2 joints, yeah. Right. What was the relationship of John Sinclair to the MC5?
Well, John was officially our manager, but he was really... See, we had tried to work with, like, music business-type managers before, and it never worked because we were really insane. We were unmanageable. And John was the first guy we met that actually the band respected, that, you know, John's analysis made sense to us, and John's, you know, political stance and cultural background made sense to us. And John admitted that, you know, he didn't know what he was doing either, that, you know, he had just learned from the Grateful Dead. They didn't know what they were doing. And they said, yeah, we've got these corporations to give us money, these record companies, and you could do it too. So we said, hell yes, let's try. What would you be if you didn't try?
My guest is Wayne Kramer. In the 60s, he was a founding member of the MC5. His new CD is called Adult World. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is guitarist, songwriter, and singer Wayne Kramer. He has a new CD called Adult World. In the 60s, he was a founding member of the MC5. When we left off, he told us that in the late 60s, the band was signed by Elektra Records. So you got a record company contract.
We did indeed.
And then you went around recording things like Kick Out the Jams, Mother Expletive Deleted, which couldn't very well be played on the radio. And I'm sure the record company wasn't really thrilled that the lyrics to your song had an expletive, like the king of expletives on it. So what were you thinking?
Or the queen of expletives.
What were you thinking when you got this good album contract, this good record deal, and then, you know, recorded a song on it that couldn't possibly play it and that you had to know would be considered a real liability to the record company?
Well, you know, the song had this introduction, you know, where we came out and we screamed at the top of our lungs, Kick Out the Jams, MF. but, you know, we weren't complete idiots about it. You know, we knew that that would never be played on the radio. So we recorded an alternative intro, which was Kick Out the Jams, Brothers and Sisters. And, you know, it might be an interesting footnote to look at it, because what happened was we knew that, I mean, Kick Out the Jams, MF, was not going to be a hit single. So we did this other version, and what we told Elektra Records was that we knew when the album version, the real version, hit the stands that the stuff was going to hit the fan. But let the single get as firmly established in the charts as it can. Wait till it starts coming back down the charts before you put the album out, because then they won't be able to stop us, you know, because then we'll be a bona fide hit band. And then the controversy will work in our favor, you know, because we're telling the truth here. And the record company, in all their short-sighted lack of wisdom, when the single started going up the charts, they rushed the album out. And when they rushed the album out, of course, the stuff did hit the fan, and the and people started to be arrested for selling the album. Kids in record stores or clerks were being arrested for selling this obscene record. And this is hard to understand in today's climate of, you know, of hip-hop and hardcore rap, you know, where MF is every third expression. But in those days, this was a major crisis. And, of course, the music industry wanted nothing to do with it and, in fact, banned the MC5 from then on, really. That was really, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, because nobody wanted anything to do with the MC5. We were way too much trouble, way too much bother.
Well, why don't we hear Kick Out the Jams? We'll hear the original version with the expletive in it. We will conveniently bleep the expletive, but still you'll get the point of the recording. So here it is, the MC5.
Kick out the jams! Kick out the jam. Yes, kick out the jam. I have to kick them out.
Kick Out the Jams, expletive deleted. And my guest is one of the founders of the MC5, Wayne Kramer. He has a new CD called Adult World. On one of the MC5 recordings, Ramblin' Rose, there's a live introduction by Jesse Crawford, who was the White Panther Minister of Information.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a kind of standard thing in concerts that one of the White Panthers would come up and give their rap before a performance?
Well, we were all ministers of something or another. We were, you know, ministers of culture in the streets, ministers of defense, ministers of, I hope it comes across that this stuff was done with a lot of humor. You know, we really weren't, you know, it didn't get heavy till much later. It was really done with a lot of fun in the early days. But that was J.C. Crawford's role. He was our MC. You know, our master of ceremonies. And we tried to build this show based on our heroes, and one of them was James Brown. And James Brown has an MC that would come out and say, you know, and now the hardest working man in show business here to sing such hits as Try Me, da-da, I'll Go Crazy, da-da. So we took that spirit of what he was doing, and JC came up with his own text on it. And, because we want to make this a show. We wanted to entertain people and take them someplace they hadn't been before. Because the world, as far as we could see, I mean, there were some awful bands back in those days. You know, the California bands were terrible. You know, they could barely play. And they would come into Detroit, you know, with these huge reputations. And we'd say, God, you guys, man, kick out the jams or get off the stage, you know. Because we were focused on this idea of high energy. We wanted to have energy in our performance because that was the thing that felt the best. And when I listen to music, if I listen to black gospel music, there's a visceral commitment. There's a visceral energy to it. There's a spirit to it that touches me. The music of James Brown, the music of Chuck Berry, and the free jazz music. You know, I even heard it in, you know, the music of The Who or some early Rolling Stones tracks. It had that energy. So that was the thing we focused on. So the having the MC was part of that to create this entire spectacular event.
So instead of having the James Brown MC talking about his hits, you had J.C. Crawford saying, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Exactly.
let's hear the introduction to Ramblin' Rose and hear some of Ramblin' Rose.
Great.
As well. You're singing lead on this.
That's me, yeah.
Brothers and sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution.
That's right.
You must choose, brothers. You must choose. It takes 5 seconds. 5 seconds of decision. 5 seconds to realize your purpose here on the planet. It takes 5 seconds to realize that it's time to move. It's time to get down with it. Brothers, it's time to testify, and I want to know, are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you a testimonial. The MC Factor.
MC5's recording Ramblin' Rose, the lead vocal in that sung by my guest, Wayne Kramer, who has a new CD called Adult World. What kind of crowd reactions would you get? What were the best reactions? What were the most extreme reactions?
Well, probably the best reactions we got were in the Detroit area, you know, because we played there regularly for years, and we had a regular job at the Grandy Ballroom, and we created that audience in Detroit and groomed them to be the best rock and roll audience in the world. And, you know, we were able to transmit that to Chicago, to Cleveland, to New York. And ultimately, we carried our message across the sea to England. But it never really translated on the West Coast. The hippies just didn't connect with the MC5. You know, we had too much macho energy. Our clothes were too shiny. Our amps were too big. And we did too much leaping, spinning, screaming, hollering, feedback. And, you know, California was all about, you know, wear some flowers in your hair. And we were just out of sync with the West Coast.
Wayne Kramer was a founding member of the MC5. He has a new CD called Adult World. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, being watched by the FBI. We continue our conversation with Wayne Kramer about his work with the radical band the MC5. He has a new solo album. Also, Jeff Nunberg on the linguistic disagreement between the cultural right and the postmodernists. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Wayne Kramer. In the 60s, he was a founding member of the Detroit-based band the MC5, a band that was considered politically and musically radical and played at many political protests and demonstrations in the 60s. Their first manager was John Sinclair, the head of the radical White Panther Party. The MC5 is now considered a forerunner of punk rock. The band broke up in 1972. A new documentary about the band will soon be shown at the Chicago Underground Film Festival and the Toronto Film Festival. Wayne Kramer is still making music. His new CD, Adult World, is released on his new label, Muscle Tone Records. Now, because of the like revolutionary language that you used with the band and your association with John Sinclair, I think you were watched pretty closely. And I'm wondering if you ever got your Freedom of Information Act files and if you could see for sure what the FBI was doing regarding your band.
Today, I know a great deal about what the federal government's attitude about the MC5 was, and it's very scary. The White House viewed the MC5 as a threat. We have, through the Freedom of Information, documents that go all the way to the top, that the Contel Pro program targeted the MC5 and the White Panther Party. Our phones were tapped. We were followed. We were systematically harassed, arrested, jailed. In an effort by the federal government, the state government, and the city of Detroit, the Detroit Police Department in particular, to squash the MC5. Because the attitude was, you know, when is somebody going to do something about this band? You know, that we can't allow this rock band to say the things they're saying, to do the things they're doing, and influence our children this way. It wasn't a joke, you know, and it got more serious as time went on. In various court actions against us, and I read an interview with G. Gordon Liddy in Playboy magazine, and he said he read our propaganda, and where we said we were willing to use any means necessary to destroy the system and start over, and he said I took them seriously. And so we used everything we had against them.
And so what did you think of what he said? How seriously should he have taken you? How should he have interpreted what you were saying?
I think he took it correctly. If we could have changed the world, we would have, you know.
How did it affect the band when John Sinclair, worked as your manager and mentor in a way, when he was arrested for carrying two marijuana joints and sentenced to 10 years, what did that do to your band?
Kind of broke our back,
mm-hmm.
really, you know, because John was the interface between the band and the outside world. And even though, you know, he was as crazy as we were, he at least had the wherewithal to be able to talk, you know, and explain what we were trying to do in a manner that people could understand. People in the music business mostly, you know. And we never really found, a champion after that. You know, we tried to work with a couple other managers, but it just never worked. You know, it was square pegs in a round hole. The MC5 really were unmanageable. Still are.
so how did you fare without Sinclair?
Well, not very well. You know, we made a couple more records, but the MC5 didn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the story ends on a very, you know, on a heartbreaking note. You know, all the joy and all that promise in the early days, all in the end, you know. The band broke up, and the band broke up amidst, drug abuse and, you know, recriminations and resentments and being broke. But, the worst thing that happened at the end was that we lost each other. And now Fred Smith and Rob Tyner have left this earthly plane. I've been able to reclaim my lost brothers, and that to me is the good news. You know that I had to go a long distance away and then come back and be able to reconnect with the spirit of the MC5. You know, it's a great loss to go through when you're a young man like that, and I see it all the time in the music business. You know, young people, they get their shot. And usually it doesn't work out. And then they don't know what they're going to do. And, you know, then the allure of Jack Daniels and heroin become very powerful. And then they're really in a mess. And And there's nothing to prepare them for that. And there was nothing to prepare me for that. So I had to go through a long period and finally, you know, grieve over the loss of the band and accept that that time had come and gone in my life. And when I could do that and finally, that in the end, that allowed me to be able to do the work I do today and, you know, to be able to be the man that I represent myself to be today and to be able to sit here and talk with Terry Gross on NPR.
Well, you know, I'm thinking when the band split up that it was not only like your musical base, but it was like your foundation for seeing the world. I mean, it was like your family. It was your musical base. It was the way in which you related to the larger cultural revolution going on around you. And was it hard to just be like on your own after that, like an individual in the middle of all of this, as opposed to part of a band, part of a group?
It was impossible. You know, I was just talking last week with Elizabeth Tyner, the daughter of Rob Tyner, and she said that with her father, she always felt like he had been to the war and he wouldn't talk about it, you know. And I think, you know, that might, you know, I mean, I don't mean to diminish the fact that, you know, people go to war and it changes them. And certainly being in a rock band is not the same as going into combat. But there was definitely some combat involved, and spiritually, you know, there were such highs and such lows that, you know, it can be a lot. It changes you. Yeah, you're right. It was my whole world. It was my whole life. So, you know, I had to be able to finally accept that loss, and then you know, get on with my life today and the day I live my life, which is today, right now.
My guest is Wayne Kramer. In the 60s, he was a founding member of the MC5. He has a new CD called Adult World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, guitarist, singer, and songwriter Wayne Kramer, played with the radical band the MC5 in the 60s and early 70s. He has a new CD called Adult World. You know, we've been talking about like the revolutionary slant of the music of the MC5, but some of it was just really fun. And I thought I'd play one of the tracks that was just really fun. And this is High School. And it sounds almost like a rough draft of for the Ramones, for their rock and roll High School. I mean, do you think they listened to your High School before doing their own rock and roll High School?
I know they did.
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah, they're friends of mine. You
oh,
know?
Okay.
I was friends with Joey and Dee Dee, and I know Johnny a bit, you know. But yeah, listen, their manager was our publicist.
Oh.
So the connections are, you know, I mean, the connections are there. John Landau, who produced back in the USA, went on to manage and produce Bruce Springsteen. You know, I can see how this is idea diffusion.
Right. And Back in the USA is the album that this track is from.
Right.
Let's hear it. This is the MC5 High
All
School.
Right.
Hands up.
MC5, and by the way, the MC5 recordings are featured on a recent anthology on Rhino Records called The Best of the MC5. My guest, Wayne Kramer, is one of the founders of the group. He's still in the music business. He has a new CD, which is called Adult World, and it's on a label that he runs as well, an independent label. It was very difficult for you when the MC5 broke up, and you went through a kind of long period of addiction to heroin, alcohol. You spent some time in prison in, I think it was the mid-70s?
Mm-hmm. It's when I first started listening to All Things Considered.
Oh, that's what they all say in prison.
A lot of people in prison listen to All Things Considered. It's a great
they really?
Show. Absolutely.
That's really funny. Good. So you were in prison for what, selling drugs
to
an undercover agent.
Yeah.
What was their cover?
That they were New York mafioso drug couriers. They looked the part, and they talked the part, and they walked the part. And see, you know, when the band broke up, I really lost my connection to any spiritual principles, any principles at all, you know. And I was really kind of adrift there in a real negative time and a place. And doing wrong is a way of getting attention, too.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
And there's a whole hierarchy in the criminal underworld of, you know, being a ghetto star, you know, being a hustler, being an earner, being, you know, somebody that gets paid, someone that gets over. This is the kind of terminology that, you know, that was in my speech a lot. This is the way I thought a lot. You know, that all culminated with this huge narcotics conspiracy that I was involved in.
When you were in prison, in a federal prison in Lexington, Kentucky, you met Red Rodney, the trumpeter who early in his career played with Charlie Parker's band. And you used to play together in prison. What kind of music would you play?
Yeah, probably the high point of being locked up for 2.5 years was the time I spent with Red Rodney. He was, I grew up admiring jazz musicians and drug addict jazz musicians and alcoholic writers, and I wanted to be like those people, you know. And finally, you know, being in prison with Red Rodney, you know, he really became like my musical father, and actually taught me a course in a Berklee music correspondence course in music theory, and we played bebop. It was I went in a pretty adventurous rock guitar player and came out I'd like to think a competent musician, you know. He was a wonderful man, and I love him dearly, you know. I think about him a lot. In fact, there's a song on Adult World that I wrote about him called The Red Arrow.
I thought we could play that. Do you want to say anything about it?
I think I just did.
Okay. Good enough. This is The Red Arrow from Wayne Kramer's new CD, Adult World.
Well, the notes came out his horn, the street corners and fried food. Folks laughing in a nightclub, swinging in a mellow mood. Out the horn game city night. On 52nd Street, dope fiends under neon lights, moving to the beat. Red Arrow could play anything. The man could read fly shit, from Brahms to Beethoven, the latest Broadway hit. He carried himself with style, and a fine new hipster grace, and a song inside his heart. Smile on his face. The Red Arrow rode it hard, played it deep. The Red Arrow hit the heart, played the deep.
Song dedicated to the late trumpeter Red Rodney on Wayne Kramer's new CD, Adult World. You talked about how you really admired artists who were alcoholics or drug addicts. What did you find interesting or admirable about that?
Well, it just seems so illicit and so romantic. But, you know, none of those things made me an alcoholic or a drug addict.
What did?
It doesn't work that way. What makes me a drug addict and an alcoholic is I like the effect that those substances have on me when I put them in my body.
How hard is it for you now to stay straight?
Well, hard. You know, it's not that it's hard, because I know today that I don't have a drug and an alcohol problem. I have a living problem. And
What do you mean?
Well, see, drugs and alcohol make it possible for me to live in a world that I can't live in, you know, because I've got so many resentments, you know, because I'm angry about the MC5, because I'm angry that, you know, my peers are all wealthy and I'm not. You know, I'm angry because I didn't get the girl I wanted. I'm angry, you know, I have resentments. I have all this baggage that I carry with me, and it makes the world a world I can't live in. So fortunately, I've been able to find a way to live where drinking isn't necessary and getting high isn't necessary, and that I can have a good life, a full life, and be grateful for every day that I have in this life, you know.
So among the things you have in your life now is your music. You're running your own record company label, your own record label that your new CD is on. Why do you want your own label? You talked a little bit earlier about the problems you had with record companies in the MC5 era.
Well, maintaining a career as a professional musician is very hard. You know, the focus of the industry in general, the gatekeepers, you know, the five major labels, is to sell records to teenagers. And I'm hardly a teenager at this point. I'm 54 years old. But I feel like a lot of us have grown up with rock music now. We've been around for a while, and we know all about the Rolling Stones and Chuck Berry and Led Zeppelin, and we know all these records, and we've grown up with it. But that a lot of music doesn't come down the line for people over 35. And a lot of people over 35 still want to rock, but there's no rock out there for them, or it's limited. You know, I mean, there's Tom Waits and there's Steve Earle and Annie DeFranco, and there's a few other people that are doing what I call grown-up rock or rock music for grown-ups. But, you know, it just doesn't get marketed to us. You know, Fred Durst and Linkin Park and Britney Spears just don't speak to me. They're not talking about anything I'm interested in, you know. So I feel like maybe there's some other people out there that feel like I do, you know, that want to hear something that still has a spirit to it, that's still passionate, that doesn't insult your intelligence, that rocks.
Wayne Kramer, his new CD, Adult World, is released on his new label, Muscle Tone Records. A documentary about the MC5 will be shown this month at the Chicago Underground Film Festival and next month at the Toronto Film Festival. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the grammar war between cultural conservatives and postmodernists. This is Fresh Air. Over the past few years, critics on the cultural right have been going after academic theories described as postmodernism. They accuse the postmodernists of moral relativism and encouraging the idea that there are no standards of right or wrong. But our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has been listening to what postmodernists say about grammar, and he thinks the critics have got postmodernism dead wrong.
Like a lot of my favorite stories, this one begins with a pronoun. Not long ago, there was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education that quoted Harvard President Lawrence Summers in an interview saying, "I regret any faculty member leaving a conversation feeling they are not respected." That sentence was tailor-made to rile the purists, particularly given the context and the speaker. And in fact, a few weeks later, the Chronicle ran a long diatribe from a professor of English who took exception to Summers' grammar. According to the writer, Summers should have said, "I regret any faculty members leaving," not "any faculty member leaving." And the antecedent "any faculty member" required the pronouns "he or she," not "they." That "he or she" business is a construction that modern academics are particularly attached to, since it enables them to sound politically correct and pedantic in the same breath. The professor went on to chide President Summers for contributing to the general decline of precision in language. All the more distressing when Summers has presented himself as a defender of scholarly rigor. Indeed, he said, "The woeful state of the language is evident to anyone who listens to National Public Radio for 15 minutes or reads a single section of the New York Times. That's what happens when students are taught that writing is a form of pure self-expression, to the point where composition teachers have a horror of acting as language police and grammar itself is regarded as a form of reactionary tyranny." The response went on in that vein for a full 1,800 words, and concluded with an insistence that all college composition courses should henceforth teach grammar and rhetoric and nothing else. In short, it was an utterly familiar harangue, distinguished only by the speciousness of the occasion for it. That business about having to use the possessive "any members leaving" instead of "any member leaving" is one of those mindless superstitions that's been passed on to generations of schoolchildren at the end of Sister Petra's ruler. If you really believed it was incorrect, in fact, you'd have to take a red pencil to Shakespeare, Milton, Jane Austen, and most of the other great figures of English literature. And as for the plural pronoun "they," bear in mind that Summers' words were quoted from a spoken interview, and that everybody uses "they" this way in their informal speech. The only thing that made this disquisition notable was that its author was the redoubtable Stanley Fish, the literary theorist and self-styled champion of postmodern thought. In fact, Fish's piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education appeared at about the same time as another extended public pronouncement of his, this one in the July issue of Harper's Magazine, where Fish offered a rejoinder to the attacks on postmodernism that come from the cultural right. That anti-postmodernist jihad has been waged with particular ferocity since 9/11, as the right invokes the September attacks in an effort to score a decisive victory in the culture wars. The first salvo was fired just 10 days after the attacks by Edward Rothstein, the one-minute intellectual who's resident in the New York Times culture pages. According to Rothstein, the postmodernists would be unable to condemn the attacks in an unqualified way since they reject universal values and ideals. In fact, he said, "Postmodernism leads to establishing a moral symmetry between the terrorist and his opponent." And the U.S. News and World Report commentator John Leo warned that our campus cultures have been captured by the postmodern conviction that there are no truths or moral norms worth defending. The result of that, Leo says, is an anything-goes morality and a drumbeat of rule-breaking that drowns out traditional values. Now, you don't have to be a devotee of academic fashion to see that this is all meretricious claptrap. And in his Harper's article, Fish rightly points out that the postmodernism that the conservatives are attacking is a grotesque caricature of what he and others have actually said. In fact, postmodernist has become a kind of boogeyman word that conservatives use in something like the way that the church used to talk about Masons. But more to the point, the attacks on postmodernism are bizarre on the face of things. I'll grant you that there's a lot of academic theorizing that's variously flaky or pretentious, though neither flakiness nor pretension is a particularly new development in American academic discourse. But it takes a singularly loopy turn of mind to see any of this as a social menace. Anybody who seriously believes that the American moral order is threatened by our literature professors should get back on their meds immediately. It isn't simply that the enterprises of philosophy and literary study have always been inconsequential in American life, and even in the American Academy. More to the point, there's no group more deeply invested in traditional standards and cultural hierarchy than academic humanists are, whatever theory they drive to work. In fact, when you read Fish's linguistic screed in the Chronicle of Higher Education, it's patently clear just how absurd the whole campaign against postmodernism has been. No norms worth defending, drumbeats of rule-breaking, one standard is as good as another. When it comes to the crunch, Fish has ideas about standards that are every bit as conventional and as unconsidered as anything the cultural right could wish for. And most of his colleagues would readily endorse those grammatical values, even if they might not put the argument quite so splenetically. The future of the Republic is in safe hands.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Linley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ABC News correspondent John Miller interviewed Osama bin Laden in 1998. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about that experience and his new book, Inside the 9/11 Plot and Why the FBI and CIA Failed to Stop It. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.